This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Anybody who has a teenager can tell you that the mood swings are hard to handle. Researchers once thought that this was all because of hormones. But in the last 20 years or so, neuroscientists have begun to get a better picture of brain development. And it turns out the teenage brain undergoes radical changes in structure. And the experiences that a teenager has during this development are going to influence their personalities for the rest of their lives. Two scientists document the effects of brain development on teen behavior in their new book, What Are They Thinking? The Straight Facts About the Risk-Taking, Social Networking, and Developing Teen Brain. Aaron White is a co-author of the book. He works for the National Institutes of Health, but before that was an assistant professor of psychiatry at Duke University Medical Center. And Aaron White is with us now. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
So this is any of us who have either been a teenager and remember any part of it or have had teenagers know that that teens are another species and another species all of a sudden. But tell us what's changed, because we used to just attribute everything to hormones and just hope that they survived long enough to grow out of it, right?
Right. No, this is a fascinating area of science, at least to me. It's rare that you see true paradigm shifts, and that's what's happened here over the last 20 years or so. As you mentioned, until very recently, the assumption was all that cantankerous behavior and tumult that happens on the pathway to adulthood is driven by hormones, and we now know that that's part of the picture. Clearly, hormones influence behavior, mood, but there are all kinds of things happening in the brain during the adolescent years that both help explain why we act the way we do when we're teens and also help explain why it's so important to get that stage of development right as parents and members of the community. How much can happen during those years that influences the rest of our lives.
So obstinance is an important part of human development.
Yes.
We have to do this thing.
Right. That's right. Wait,
and tell us about it. So from a neurobiological standpoint, what's going on with the brain at that period somewhere between 10, 11, 12 years of age?
Yes. I think we're sort of still looking at the tip of the iceberg, but it's a really interesting story so far. What has been discovered is essentially that as we move from roughly 10 to 20, ages 10 to 20, through the adolescent years, what happens is the brain undergoes a shift from having behavior driven by emotion, that's at the front end of adolescence, to having the brain make decisions based on processing and foresight. And so when we enter adolescence, about the age of 10 or so, it is the expectation we have as adults is that our kids are going to be difficult, that they're going to have some trouble controlling impulses, that they're going to act on their feelings. They're going to be up and down and all around. But when they come out the other side, we expect them to be able to regulate those emotions, those drives, and to make decisions that are forward-thinking and rational. And when you look at what's happening in the brain, you actually can see anatomical changes and functional changes that fit as an explanation for those behavioral changes. And they primarily involve a shift from control of behavior driven by limbic structures, what we tend to call limbic
emotional structures,
to the frontal lobes, which are right behind the forehead, which allow us to really control our emotional expression and think about the outcomes of our actions.
That's the think about it part
of
the brain.
Yeah, the think about it part of the brain. Right.
And so
that shift, as that shift is happening, it's timed perfectly with the major goal of adolescence, which is to get out of the nest. To go out into the world, whether it be a digital world or an actual world, to explore, meet people, learn to socialize, to basically prepare oneself for adult life. So as these brain changes are happening, we're interacting with the world, and the world then molds how that brain, those brain changes unfold. Yeah.
The big wide world and not the world of mommy and daddy. And this has important adaptive implications. In other words, we really want, at least genetically, we would like for that teenager to stop accepting what mommy and daddy said as gospel and looking at them as the only world they know and to explore a wider world. Because in terms of the gene pool, that's going to be important, like it or not.
Well, that's absolutely correct. And that's I'm not sure if we mentioned this in the book, but we in this field tend to refer to that as that process of swimming to the deep end of the gene pool. We want to get our kids out of the shallow end, out in the deep end. As hard as that is for us as parents to give them a longer leash and let them do those things, they have to do it. It's important for the species that they do it.
So one of the things they do, on the other hand, and that we don't want them to do, is practice risky behavior, things that we know because we have hopefully developed that frontal lobe a little bit better and the relationship between the rest of the brain. They're still in the process of hooking up the wires, right, and getting those structures built inside their brain. So they're going to do things that could kill them.
That's exactly correct. And in fact, we are built for that. We're built to be risky. It's an important part of that developmental process. You're not going to swim to the deep end of the gene pool if doing so scares you to death.
So the good news is this is something that propels them, as you say, to the deep end of the gene pool that allows for variety, which is all what we need. Bad news is some of that risk can actually interfere with the development of the brain. And I'm thinking of some of the substance abuse, substances that kids may try along the way that interfere with this process of normal brain development.
Well, that's correct too. It's fascinating. The brain is built to learn. During adolescence, you know, we're supposed to push away from our families, go out and explore, take some chances, and allow the brain to be molded like crazy by those experiences. Because the brain assumes, that whatever's going on during adolescence, this must be vital stuff for survival for the rest of one's life. You need to learn how to find a mate. You need to learn how to socialize. You need to learn how to, to function out there. The trick is that if the behaviors that one engages in are unhealthy, they have the same tendency to stick as well. So the good stuff and the bad stuff will be molded into the brain. Now, what really works against us when we're adolescents is something that really works for us evolutionarily. The brain has a built-in system for reinforcing us when we do something that the brain assumes is good for our survival. So you're thirsty, you drink water, it feels good. You get an A on a test, you get a hug, that feels good. You know, you get a job, you get some money, that feels good. We have these things that we call drugs, which are very diverse substances that have one thing in common, and that is that they activate that reinforcement system and essentially trick the brain into thinking you just did something really good. The teen brain is built such that the reward system, the reinforcement system, is quiet in general. We feel blah, we're bored. But then when we find something that activates it, it lights up like a pinball machine, to give us a real strong signal-to-noise ratio so that we know when we've found something that is reinforcing to us. And the brain then says, okay, well, this must be valuable. You better learn about this, pay attention to it, and repeat it, because what a big signal that was. Well, it's hard to find normal life experiences that will light up the reward system the way that, say, even alcohol will, or nicotine to some extent, or cocaine, or some of these other drugs. They really just light up that reward system. So the brain goes, hey, that was important. And the frontal lobes are just kind of standing on the sidelines, not really offering their two cents about whether this is a good thing long term.
Right.
And they don't really have the full ability to control that urge to repeat the behavior. So what we find is that when substance use begins during adolescence, even if it's at a low level, I'm talking, just occasional drinking, the odds of becoming dependent on that substance at some point in one's life are much higher.
So this raises a couple of interesting questions. I mean, the fact that I know all of this as the adult, now I'm the parent, and I understand that brain development is part of what's going on. I don't just stand back and say, well, I get it. That's what your brain's doing. So we'll just watch you act this way.
Right. Right.
I mean, so you're not suggesting that that's
no,
that just
no, no,
knowing
no.
this is now permission to go ahead and do it.
No,
you'll
no.
get through this.
No, it's well, I mean, there's good news. There's good news in here. And that is that we are incredibly resilient as adolescents. And so most of us get through it and with some scrapes and bruises, but we end up OK. I think really what the data say are that the data say that that as parents, and not just parents, members of the community in general, we really have to serve as best we can as the training wheels for teenagers' frontal lobes and recognize that they're going to want to veer off to the left and to the right and do their own thing, and they push away from us and they don't trust us. And in fact, the brain research says that teens seem to have kind of a mild paranoia of all adults. So we're just built that way. But we still have to try to really create some boundaries within which they can explore and take chances without really getting injured.
So it seems to me that the interesting thing is you can, as a parent, learn if you know all this. You know, if you read your book, what are they thinking? You might understand, oh, you might not take it personally when they wake up one morning and suddenly you're the dumbest man on earth. On the other hand, that doesn't mean you take your hands off the wheel and let nature take its course, because there are lots of risks out
there.
That's
precisely correct. There may have been a time in our history as humans when it was a bit safer to take your hands off the wheel and just kind of let them do the steering. Not now. There's too many pitfalls, too much going on.
Let's talk about that now, because at that time in our history that you refer to, and still places on the globe, fewer and fewer, there are rites of passage that I think are specifically designed culturally and socially to help young people, help adolescents navigate this difficult time. We certainly have lost those and haven't had those for a couple of centuries in a way. What impact does that have? And then also talk about technology in general.
Sure. Right. Everything is changing in this sense of rites of passage, and some of it is has to do with just a broad cultural thing. We still have a few: driving, voting age, being able to buy alcohol. But there's something fascinating happening here that we don't really understand yet, but it's an interesting development, and that is the life expectancy of humans. Americans. The life expectancy of Americans has lengthened greatly over the last 100 years. 100 years ago, we were lucky to live to 45. That was like the average age at which we died. Now it's about 80. I mean, that's a lot of extra living to do. Everything has stretched out, perhaps because life is lasting longer for us, and because of the economic sort of security we have. We're not quite sure why, but adolescence itself is stretching. It's important to point out, there's two concepts here that are related but are not the same: puberty and adolescence. Puberty is the biological, the biological transformation that happens that prepares us to function as adults, to be able to have children and take care of them. Adolescence is the learning how to do that in the culture as it is now. So they're two sides of the same coin, sort of. When puberty starts, early in puberty, let's just say around the age of 10, the brain development phase that we usually attribute to adolescence kicks in. So as puberty is unfolding like a bunch of dominoes, the brain development kicks in, and then the brain is offered up to the culture to be molded by experience to prepare that individual to use that sexual and physical maturation to function. They used to run in parallel, presumably. And that's why a lot of people think, oh, well, adolescence is a new phenomenon. It's just a new thing. Well, no, it's always been there, but it used to run so closely with puberty that it looked like the same thing. You start to become physically able to work on a farm. You learn how to work on the farm. You're 18. You're physically mature. Now you're a young adult. That's not the case anymore. We don't hand off responsibility, adult responsibility, to our kids until much later, for most kids, late 20s even. Now, at the same time, puberty is starting earlier and earlier. Much earlier, about 4 years earlier, based on if you look at menstrual data for females over the last 100 years or so. So that means, presumably, the brain development is starting earlier, but we're not doing the molding until later. We could be missing the window of brain moldability, for all we know. But there's now a disconnect between the puberty and the adolescent phases of that development. It's a fascinating time, and we're waiting to see what that means. We just don't have the data.
Well, you talked about driving, and we've come to see that as a rite of passage. We call it a rite of passage, but how different that is from other cultural kinds of rites of passage in which men and young boys and girls are segregated and come up in a very communal, rigid kind of culture to shape them for the world they're going to live in. Mm-hmm. And driving is precisely independence. You're on your own. Go do whatever you want. And you're not part of any other group.
Yes.
So it would seem to me social media is something that, again, reinforces this independent way of learning about the culture on your own mm-hmm. without any guideposts or structure culturally.
True. We have a chapter in the book. There have been other books on this topic of adolescent brain development over the last 10 years or so. And my co-author and I, you know, we sort of waited. We're neuroscientists and psychologists, and we waited until it was clear there was enough data to actually say something here that's meaningful, not just, you know, just speculate. But when it comes to the social media stuff and video games and all of that, you know, there's more speculating than there is science. There's stuff we know and there's a lot we don't. And for instance, it's surprising to me to find out that in terms of social media, it can actually be beneficial for teens who have social anxiety because they can interact without having to endure the anxiety that's produced by seeing people face to face. Whether there's a consequence to this, to not being in front of an actual warm body when we interact with people, we don't know yet. You know, if that has an impact on how we function as adults, we just simply don't know.
Well, you also talk about the impact of drugs. The social anxiety is one, and we have a lot more pharmaceuticals now to take care of all that, and we think that maybe 10% of our kids have some form of attention deficit. If you think about 10% of the population, you have to wonder if indeed that's a disorder or if we're kind of a disordered culture that can't handle these kids who are on the outside. What are the risks and benefits of using medication at a time when this brain is not fully developed?
Mm-hmm. It's something that that requires watching of the data as they come in. Right now, I think the wise course of action when it comes to meds and kids is a cost-benefit analysis or sort of a risk-benefit analysis. You've got a kid who has trouble sitting still in class, paying attention, got the ADHD diagnosis, and you're trying to decide, do I medicate my child? His or her brain is not done developing. What's the impact? Well, it's very clear that if they can't interact with the world in a healthy way, they're not going to learn the things they need to learn in order to grow and develop and become, you know, successful adults. So in that case, I would say if the medications help, so far the data don't paint a picture suggesting that it's necessarily deleterious to give our kids meds. If they improve their conduct and their ability to interact with the world, the benefits may outweigh the risk. Now, there are dose issues. There are the fit of the med. I think parents should be very cautious, but I think it's important they understand that they're not doing something evil to their kid or damaging their brain if they really do have to go down the medication route. You just have to be careful, thoughtful, do your research, and make careful choices.
I've got to ask you this in light of the research that you've done. North Carolina is one of the few states that tries 16-year-olds as adults. Given the research that you've done on the 16-year-old brain, it doesn't sound to me like that's an adult brain yet.
Well, it isn't. And particularly at that age, I mean, that's where the frontal lobes may be doing a better job of regulating emotions and controlling behavior than, say, when you're 12. But it's still a time when emotions run very high. We can become very volatile very quickly. And the frontal lobes have a real task on their hand to try to regulate those things, particularly if you add in environmental molding that would put one closer to the point of violence, let's say, or other crimes. I mean, when you look at the risk factors for crime in adults, teens tend to have a lot of those by nature of development: impulse control issues, mood issues. These are things that they tend to come with them. Same thing when you look at the risk for substance abuse. When you look at the symptoms for depression, they tend to have a lot of those symptoms by nature. This is a volatile time. Whether or not we ought to charge our teens with adults for crimes, I mean that's really outside of my comfort zone to make a statement about. But I would caution that this is not a fully developing brain that is capable of really carefully thinking through the consequences of one's actions. We tend to be very socially driven, much more so at that age. So if you add a social context, you add some substances, you add a difficult home environment, I mean, this is a powder keg. So this is not an adult brain. But the legal the legal issue is something I'm not going to tackle.
Aaron, thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Aaron White, co-author of What Are They Thinking? The Straight Facts About the Risk-Taking, Social Networking, Still Developing Teen Brain. He works for the National Institutes of Health. Before that was an assistant professor of psychiatry at Duke University's Medical Center. There's more of the state of things ahead. Stay tuned.